minor. Yeah, I guess that's the way it is. So many things going on down there, and I guess hockey as well. So we're back to an experimental talk now. And as you know, in experimental physics, serendipity is really one of our key tools. And so I'm really not ashamed to admit that all of this work came out of a pure sort of coincidence, because some years, and we continue to do so, we've been working on frustrated magnetism, trying to sort of chart out the landscape for what can happen when you have quantum spins in frustrated interactions with each other. We knew that both those things developed sort of non-collinear spin states at low temperatures, and we had been looking at those, but what we didn't know was that under some conditions, those states can actually also be ferroelectric. So you can get a coupling between these non-collinear spin configurations and ferroelectric polarization. And that's kind of cute, and it was really popular, as you know, in this context of multiferroic materials. And it turned out that most of the things that we've been looking at recently actually were multiferroic, just sort of by coincidence. And so these things have the ability to, or have the behavior that if you apply an electric field, you can actually change the magnetic state of the system. And this is the unusual aspect of them. You can also change the ferroelectric polarization by applying a magnetic field. In principle, there may be applications of this at some point. That's not our main concern. The application that I'm somewhat interested in, I should say interested in, is the possibility of really using this aspect of frustrated systems to introduce a new type of perturbation, the electric field, so you can actually change the symmetry of a frustrated system close to the phase transition, typically. So this seems like an interesting direction to go in. Let's see, so here's the outline of the talk. I'll say a few words about magnetoelastic effects and frustrated magnets. And then I'm mainly going to talk about a couple of different systems to illustrate the behaviors that we found. And the latest thing that we've had fun with is the experiments to control the spin chirality by applying an electric field. And there'll be some conclusions and outlook. And of course, please interrupt me with your questions as we go along. There are some sort of theoretically minded slides in this, and that's mostly due to the collaboration with Brooks Harris and Amnon Aharoni and company. So I'll be presenting some of that, and certainly you should be able to answer your questions, hopefully. Okay, so that's the outline. And then I want to start off just with the basic underlying, I think, microscopic physics, which is at play here. Very, very simple stuff. But very often neglected when we think about magnetism and insulators, because we typically like to think about an exchange interaction, some sort of Heisenberg exchange interaction, and we want that interaction to be a constant, or we kind of don't worry about it possibly depending on the lattice in any way. But of course, in reality, the lattice is somewhat compliant, and when the lattice moves, then these exchange constants are going to somehow change. And so there will be these magnetoelastic effects. They're just always going to be there. In many cases, they don't matter very much. In this case, they matter a lot. So this is the main thing that we have to pay attention to. And just sort of a rough sketch, which is actually due to my colleague Ulrich Chernyshov, is, of course, the energy of such a spin configuration. Let's see here, I might be thinking of chromium atoms and oxygen atoms here. And so that would be a direct exchange interaction, or it could be nickel and oxygen atoms, then it would be a super exchange interaction. But in any event, the energy of this configuration is going to depend on the spin state, whether it's a singlet or triplet configuration. And of course, the splitting between the singlet and the triplet, well, that would be if it's spin half, it's something else, then we can talk about a parallel alignment of spins and antiparallel alignment. The energy of that will certainly depend on the strength of this exchange constant, which depends on the overall electronic and structural configuration in the vicinity. Very complicated stuff that we don't really want to get into detail with. So we just think of it as mapped on one spatial variable. And so you could imagine sort of splitting these two apart a little bit, and then certainly the exchange constant will decrease. There will be some sort of overall change in the configuration of things that we are not really going to worry about. So if you just seem to map it onto a spatial variable, then if I have an antiferromagnetic exchange interaction here between the spins, but I find the spins in this type of frustrated configuration, then there's actually going to be a real force which is going to try to push these spins apart in that way. And correspondingly, if I have a set of spins which are in a favorable configuration with respect to each other, that is favorable as compared to the exchange interaction, then they will want to move in such ways so that the strength of the exchange interaction is enhanced. And as I said, mostly we don't worry too much about these things. But what is going to happen in our case is that we're going to have charge on these atoms. And so when they move, there is the potential for developing electric polarization if that motion is one which breaks spatial inversion symmetry. All right. Let me, though, mention the importance of these types of magnetostriction effects in other contexts of frustrated and sort of low-dimensional magnetism, because sometimes these effects are really very, very important. And the sort of standard example that we know of is the spin piles effect, which occurs in a chain of antiferromagnetically interacting spin half atoms. And of course, this is the lovely model that was invented by Bethe many, many years ago. And there's such a lot of wonderful mathematical physics that flows from that. And mostly you don't worry about the possibility of the exchange constant somehow changing or varying with the lattice conditions there. And so you end up with a state which is actually a quantum critical state of the system of spin half ions interacting with each other. But this state, by definition, because it's critical, is strongly dependent on any changes that might occur in the exchange constant. So there you get into a situation where, in fact, these types of magnetoelastic effects are very, very important. And the system is not stable if the lattice is compliant in any fashion. And so in a material such as this copper germanate, discovered many years ago by Haas et al., in this context at least, they found that there was a phase transition in which the lattice, you expend some lattice energy in order to localize the singlet so that you no longer have this resonating valence bond state, but you fix the singlets on nearest neighbors as such. And these arrows here are simply indicating what is happening to the local environment in order to modulate the exchange interaction. So it's stronger here and weaker there, always antiferromagnetic, but pointing to this as being the pair that should be in the antiferromagnetic singlet type configuration. And you see really a qualitative change in the, or dramatic change, if you will, in the susceptibility, which is behaving as Bonner Fischer at high temperature, and then sets down towards exponentially activated behavior at low temperature, indicating that you have introduced a gap in the excitation spectrum by breaking the translational symmetry. So that's an example of really important features associated with magnetoelastic effects. And I also want to mention that in frustrated magnetism, magnetoelastic effects seem to be very important as well. And in fact, there's some sort of similarities between just kind of the raw data as they come off the instruments in these types of frustrated systems and in the previous antiferromagnetic chain system. So what have I got here? I have got pictures of inelastic magnetic neutron scattering from powder samples in two materials that both have this sort of cardinal structure for frustrated magnetism, the one with the corner-sharing tetrahedra. It has great troubles ordering. And so even at temperatures well below the Curie-Weiss temperature, you have fluctuations, and you have no static order, and you have very short-range spin correlations. But then on sufficiently cooling to sufficiently low temperatures, then all the spectral weight is sort of lifted up, and the gap is introduced in the spectrum. Sometimes there are spin waves below this prominent feature in the spectrum. But overall, what seems to be happening in those systems is that there are distortions that occur in order, if you will, to lower the energy of the spin system and to allow it to push spectral weight to higher energy, because that's the experimental signature of actually having lowered the energy of the spin system. So both in low dimensional and in frustrated magnets, these magnetoelastic effects are going to be important. But in this talk, we're going to focus on the situations where these magnetoelastic distortions actually also end up producing ferroelectric polarization. And let me give you another example of a magnetoelastic type effect, which is really kind of a little bit off in right field, we could say. But I would claim that it is actually quite closely related to what we were talking about here, because this is really the macroscopic, if you will, or the sort of device size manifestation of the same type of magnetoelastic type behavior. So it's a paper from some years back where one can sandwich a ferromagnetic material with a piezoelectric material. And because the ferromagnet actually is quite sensitive to strain for the same reasons that we described previously, when a ferromagnetic magnet orders, well, then there is an anomaly in the volume associated with this type of behaviors. And so you can affect that by coupling to a material that has ferroelectric properties. And now you have a system which can, where you can tune the magnetic properties with an electric field. You couple to the system through the ferroelectric material, which then distorts slightly and strains the ferromagnet and changes its properties. And these types of things are actually now proposed as elements in bandpass filters in the gigahertz range. They're just kind of an oddity. I would claim that the basic underlying physics is actually the same. It's sort of a magnetoelastic effect, but now on the scale of I don't know, millimeters, micrometers, and so on. But we're going to look at the similar type of effect, but now on the scale of atomic spacings.
Is this just for tuning the bandpass filter, or is this actually the thing that has a narrow bandpass?
It has the narrow bandpass, because you can change the ferromagnetic resonance frequency slightly by changing the magnetic susceptibility, then this actually works. And this thing is already, you know, considered as a potential way to make multi-band phones, where you can actually you can reduce the weight of the device, because you can use the same device for your bandpass filter. You don't need to have separately tuned filters in there. Okay, so that's the application side. Not something we're contributing to right now, but we're always looking at it and finding it exciting. All right, so now let me get into the actual meat of the presentation. And we're going to talk about a couple of different compounds, and many people were involved in this work. Actually, I'm going to focus on these two here. This one we won't say too much about. I want to mention in particular my former postdoc, Michelle Kenzelman, and Brooks Harris and Tanner Yildirim, who were very important for development of the theoretical understanding of this, and they were involved in all of these things. And then I also want to mention a new student who just started to work with me and has been doing these experiments that I'll talk about at the end, where we modify the magnetic state with an electric field. Okay, we are doing experimental physics, and I always feel more comfortable if I see my home as I launch into the talk here. So this is the type of instrument that we would be doing experiments on. And I will say that the structures that we try to understand are actually quite complicated. We're not talking about the very simple sort of collinear antiferromagnetic state. The whole interest and the complexity we have to deal with is non-collinear magnetic structures, where you have big unit cells and spins that are pointing in all possible directions and so on. So you actually need a pretty comprehensive set of diffraction data to solve that in a reliable fashion. It turns out that for now, those instruments exist abroad. We don't have so wonderful instruments for that type of thing here in the States. So we've been going to Switzerland, the Paul Scherrer Institute, for some of our experiments. Yes? What? we are somewhat deficient in terms of that capability, both, I think I can say North America. But very soon, very, very soon, we'll have a wonderful machine here in Tennessee at the spallation neutron source. Just want to advertise that this huge item has been built there, and we feel that we're really on the cusp of sort of revolution in neutron capabilities, and it will also impact our ability to probe these complicated structures through this interesting looking machine, which will be somewhere inside this building. All right. Very good. So now let's begin to talk about the actual materials. And I've got the first compound I wanted to talk about. It came to us from Bob Carver's lab at Princeton. And it came to us because we've always been interested in the Kagame lattice. And this thing actually has aspects of a Kagame lattice in it. It's not the ideal Kagame lattice. But we can see, you know, this hexagon type shape here showing up. But it doesn't really have, you know, a six-fold axis. It's actually somewhat squashed. And this particular line here of atoms is actually different from this line in terms of all the coordinations and so on. You can see it directly when you look at the figure. So it's an orthorhombic structure, not something that has a three-fold axis. And still, some of the aspects that make the Kagame antiferromagnet interesting survive in this structure as well. It's sort of very open configuration and the low dimensionality, the very low or pretty low connectivity as well. I think all of those things are important for producing a rather complex and interesting frustrated antiferromagnet from this. Now, there are actually two different nickel sites. All the magnetism has to do with nickel. I should have put the chemical formula on there. So nickel 3, vanadium 2, 08, and all the magnetism has to do with nickel, which is spin 1. And nickel is in red here. These are oxygen atoms. And these sites that I'm indicating here, those we call the spine sites. And these sites here we call the cross tie sites. They're crystallographically distinguishable, actually. And as we go along, it'll turn out that sort of a minimal model for magnetism in the system is actually going to be a quasi one-dimensional model of near-neighbor antiferromagnetic interactions and next near-neighbor antiferromagnetic interaction from this side all the way to that side. So these two are the kind of the basis of frustration in that system, that I cannot simultaneously satisfy a near-neighbor antiferromagnetic and a next-near-neighbor antiferromagnetic interaction. So that's the view of the structure along what we call the B-axis. The A-axis is the direction of this is the direction of the spine sites, as we call them, and perpendicular to that is C. So let me just twist and turn the structure a little bit so you can look at it. And we'll see it in a couple of different incarnation. So this is when I'm looking along the spine direction. So I'm sort of looking along this Kagame plane. You see that it's actually puckered. It sort of goes up and down. And in fact, these lines, so this line of spins would be the spine of the structure. And then there's another spine down here. So the spines are sort of puckered in and out of the plane. And then these cross tie sites that I indicated, they define the plane. All right, this thing is, of course, a real three-dimensional structure, and it's sort of stacked in this fashion. And there's some tendency for quasi-two-dimensionality, though I don't think it's a very strong tendency. There are interactions as well existing between these layers here. Okay, the reason it's called a Kagame staircase is this, essentially. You know, you can walk up the Kagame staircase. And the reason we are interested in it is because of its very complicated phase diagram. I think I'll skip that one. I'll go straight to the experimental data. Now, this is a very busy chart, but still I wanted to just go through it because I think it was how we became interested in the material. So I'm showing many different things here. Let's just start from the top here, specific heat as a function of temperature. And we can just look at zero magnetic field, which would be the dotted, the black dots, and we see 1, 2, 3, 4 magnetic phase transitions. So very rich phase diagram, etc. Very complicated, we could say. Very interesting, I would argue, because of this coupling between magnetism and ferroelectricity. So we accept that we have to look at this complexity. Now, it's interesting that the magnetization as a function of temperature doesn't actually have much of anomalies at all at these higher temperature transitions, but there is a big anomaly at the lower temperature transition here, which I think is around 4, you know, that's around 4 Kelvin, yeah. Okay, so there you actually get a small ferromagnetic moment. This is only a canted moment. It's not the full nickel moment that's come in. And this is, in the end, because of Gisel-Sinsky-Maria interactions that favor these types of canted configurations. All right, so down here are then magnetic neutron diffraction data, which show that you do, in fact, have phase transitions where various types of magnetic peaks appear, and specifically incommensurate magnetic peaks appear. And those are shown, their intensity is shown with this open circle. And you see there's this incommensurate peak appears, and then it grows stronger, and then it almost goes away. And when it almost goes away, a commensurate magnetic peak appears in its place. So this is sort of the phenomenology of the magnetic diffraction experiment. And down here is shown the temperature dependence of the incommensurate wave vector. So it's simply sliding along here. There don't seem to be really any lock-in transitions as such. Though one can say that the temperature dependence is strongest in the higher temperature phase, and then it becomes somewhat, it sort of plateaus out in this temperature range. And this lower temperature regime where I have a little remnant of the incommensurate peak is I think that's a complexity we don't really want to get into. Depending on how you prepare the sample, you can either have or not have that incommensurate peak. So let's not worry too much about that. But so many phase transitions, incommensurate magnetism. Let me put it all together on a phase diagram. And because it's an orthorhombic structure, I have three different field directions I could worry about. And I'm showing you these phase boundaries as a function of field and temperature for these three different field orientations. I'll remind you that the Kagame plane or the Kagame staircase plane is this AC plane, and the spine direction is the A direction. So these are the spins that we think are particularly strongly coupled to each other along this direction here. All right. So I would like to focus just for simplicity on this phase diagram here, which is the field applied along the C direction. So that's in the Kagame plane and actually perpendicular to the spine direction. All right. So what one finds is that there is a high temperature paramagnetic state. That's no surprise. Then one enters this green phase, which we call the high temperature incommensurate state. And then at low enough fields, there's an additional sort of variant of that, which is the low temperature incommensurate state. And then at lower temperatures still, there are various other phases, which I won't really get into. So I'm going to focus on the high temperature incommensurate state and the low temperature incommensurate state. Those will make the point that I would like to make regarding the coupling of inversion symmetry breaking magnetism and ferroelectricity. All right. Yeah. So with neutron diffraction, we can solve these structures, and it's they simply are complicated. But using group theory, we can classify them, and then it just boils down to what is the irreducible representation that we're talking about. But we still like to look at these charts, I guess. And I'm simply focusing on the, I want to focus just on the high temperature incommensurate state and the low temperature incommensurate state. And they are distinct in the following sense. They're both incommensurate in the sense that there's a magnetic periodicity that is not sort of a rational fraction of the lattice spacing. But in the high temperature incommensurate state, it's actually a uniaxial structure. The spins are always pointing along the direction of the incommensurate wave vector. So that's actually seen very easily experimentally because we've got a selection rule that cancels the intensity when wave vector is oriented along the spin. So we're very confident about that structure. Now, what is it that happens when we cool into the LTI phase? It's actually a little hard to see here, but the pluses and minuses indicate components of spins which are out of the board. So what has happened actually is that the spins, if I sort of indicate with my, may I? Sorry. With my hockey stick. So this is now my spin with my arrow, et cetera, which would be over here. The spins are just, you know, they're always pointing in that, they're always in that oriented that direction, but they can oscillate either pointing that way or that way. But in this picture here, they actually come out and point at you. They're coming out of the board like that, rotating in this fashion here. So actually rotating in the AB plane. All right. So those are the structures we have to worry about. Where could that all come from? Well, it turns out that And here I don't want to claim that we have the description of the magnetic structure and the relevant magnetic interactions in the system. That's why we come to a theoretical institute. If you would become interested, maybe you would want to worry about those details. But what we do have, thanks to Aharoni and Harris, is sort of a minimal description of a theory that could account for this type of transition from an amplitude modulated to a spiraling type antiferromagnetic state. And it's actually quite a simple simple Hamiltonian that can produce that in a mean field type approximation. You need three terms in it, a uniaxial anisotropy term, which says that the spins would like to be pointing in the A direction, say. You need a near neighbor antiferromagnetic interaction, and you need a next near neighbor antiferromagnetic interaction. And this is then the phase diagram as a function of temperature and the strength of this uniaxial anisotropy in a mean field approximation. So it's yeah.
Well, so I mean, all sorts of issues bubble up, and so on. So we could. This is just the kind of the first cut at how one could roughly understand why you have this type of behavior. And actually, it's nice to look at it in the limit of no anisotropy and then very strong anisotropy. And then you can sort of get a feeling for what's going on. If there's no anisotropy, you have a transition straight from the paramagnetic state into this spiraling phase, that is the way that you can best minimize the exchange energy under the competition between near and next near neighbor interaction. All right, on the other hand, if you go to very, very strong uniaxial anisotropy, then it's very costly to spiral out of the plane. You know, this business about pointing the stick out at you now becomes really expensive. So the spins want to stay pointing in the A direction. And then you initially go into this, what we call the high temperature incommensurate phase, which is the amplitude modulated state. Eventually, having these sites in the amplitude modulated structure where the spin is almost zero becomes very unfavorable thermodynamically. And so actually the free energy becomes unmanageable. And so you end up going into a state which kind of strains against what the exchange interactions would do. But it does manage to get full polarization on each side. And that state is a commensurate antiferromagnet. And so then if you place this uniaxial anisotropy somewhere between these two extreme limits, you can actually have the sequence of transitions from paramagnet to amplitude modulated structure, actually a structure very similar to the one that Sabir was telling us about in the morning. This I think one could call this sort of a stripe type situation. But then you go in briefly into this spiraling situation, and then finally you can make it into the commensurate antiferromagnetic state. So tuning these parameters maybe with more sophisticated analysis, one should be able to understand where that type of magnetism would come from. And it turns out that it's actually found in a number of different materials that have been studied in the context of multiferroic behaviors. The paper that sort of ignited the interest in multiferroic things was the terbium manganate paper, and it has exactly those types of phases. If I look only at zero magnetic field, then I've got the paramagnet, I've got the amplitude modulated antiferromagnet, and then the spiraling antiferromagnet eventually. And down here, we let's not worry about that complexity right now. In this compound, there are also these four different phases. In that case, however, the amplitude modulated part of the phase diagram is a very, very slender sliver, and then you get straight, and then you get eventually into this spiraling phase. Okay, so that's where these complicated non-collinear structures come from competition between near next near neighbor exchange and uniaxial anisotropy. But I said I was going to talk about ferroelectric behaviors as well, so let's turn to that. And I want to look at these magnetic structures in somewhat more detail to recognize or to understand why they also need to be ferroelectric. So I'm going to now look at the Kagame type layer, but from the side. So I'm looking now along the C direction. And these spine directions are actually coming along in this direction here. In the next chart, I have a sort of more schematic view of this. Again, I'm looking side on into a single Packard Kagame layer. And this is what the spin structures look like. In the high temperature phase, I've got this type of situation. And I want to look at the spatial inversion operator. What does that do to the spin structure? And now, the spin being an actual vector, the effect of this inversion operator, if I was to do a spatial inversion in this point, it's simply to move this spin to this location. So spin at location R becomes spin at location minus R without changing its direction, and likewise for this spin. So this is actually a point of inversion for this high temperature incommensurate structure. It doesn't break inversion symmetry, so it can't actually be ferroelectric. There's no justification for it being ferroelectric on the basis of magnetism, at least. But if we look at this low temperature incommensurate structure, that one is much more complicated, being incommensurate and so on. And we would have to look more carefully than what's indicated here. But if I was to examine whether this is a point of inversion, I would quickly recognize that it's not, because these spins actually look different from each other as do those. So this is a structure which doesn't have a spatial inversion symmetry. Once I go into the low temperature commensurate state, and I had said I wasn't going to say too much about that, but let me just mention that that one actually does have a point of inversion as well. And so we recognize that in the sequence of states that we've pointed out for the model that I was mentioning, we would actually first have a magnetically ordered state that would not be ferroelectric, then I'd become ferroelectric, and then ferroelectricity would go away again. Now that happens to be
In fact, what is, oh, well, that's another little story I have to do. Yeah, that happens to be the behavior that one finds in many of these materials, both terbium manganate, manganese tungstate, and this compound nickel vanadate. I wanted this picture, let me get to this picture. It's actually not enough for the structure to have broken spatial inversion symmetry. You can have a structure that doesn't have inversion symmetry, but which is not polar. And what does that mean? What it means now translated to this particular material is that if this structure was not polar, then I would not be able to recognize that you had turned it over. I don't know, if this, let's say that this was a Kagame slab, and I first put it on the table with the ordered magnetic structure, etc. And then you turn your back and I rotate it to the other side. Could you tell that there was a difference? That's the question you have to ask yourself. If you can tell that if there is an up and a down direction, then it is a polar structure and it should be able to be ferroelectric. This is kind of back of the envelope. We can later do the group theory properly, but I like to at least check that things make sense like this. So I have to look at this structure and decide whether I can see a difference between the, can I say that this is the top and this is the bottom? Would I be able to recognize if I turned it round that I had turned it around? And it turns out that yes, you can do that, but you have to look in some detail. And the way I figured out to worry about that was, if you think about a lady here happily driving her bicycle along, and then you associate these arrows with the spokes and the wheel. So if this bike is able to roll along this upper surface here, then I could say that is the up surface. And that's actually different from this surface down here. If I was to let the person roll along this direction, you'll see that the spins are actually rotating in the opposite direction. So it's like either the rolling action, which you have on what I'm calling the top, or the sort of counter-rotating action, which is what I have on the bottom. You have to look at it a little bit. Yes?
So what polarization is doing as you go down the direction?
It stays.
Like, it stays vertical?
Yes.
Why it doesn't have any tipping to it?
No. The point is that it doesn't have tipping associated with it. That would be forbidden by symmetry, actually. But
you're saying it has to be uniaxial in the direction.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you can.
Even in the presence of an incommensurate.
Yes. We can see it when we look at the coupling term in the Landau theory that it can only be allowed to point in that direction. It cannot have a component in any other direction. That would violate symmetry. I will say that in this talk, I'm not actually going to give you any proper microscopic justification for the terms that I will talk about in the Landau theorem. That will be sort of beyond it. I'll say a few words about it, but it's more elegant at this point, I think, not to dive into that.
What about its amplitude? Is its amplitude modulated?
Well, yeah, but that.
Okay.
Now you get into the question of if you're going to talk about the electric polarization, you probably want to go into a sort of Maxwell description, then you use an averaging,
sure.
But on the local level, of course, it will be.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so I think I have a structure that breaks inversion symmetry and which is polar. And so there's a good potential that this one should also be ferroelectric. And to be honest, I think we actually did the ferroelectric measurement sort of consecutive, more or less at the same time as the magnetic measurement. So it was not sort of a deliberate process. We were just collaborating, various of us looking at different things. And it was found that, and so now here I'm showing you data measurements of the ferroelectric polarization. This is actually just measuring the surface charge density on surfaces that are, whose normal is the B direction. So I am, going normal to the Kagame planes and finding surface charge density on the top and bottom. And that's actually done quite easily with a technique called measuring the Pyra current. You have sort of a capacitive geometry and you can back out from those measurements what the surface charge density was. And so having surface charge density means that you have bulk electric polarization. And so that means you have a ferroelectric structure. And what we've done here is, let's look at the bottom, those look nicest. So that is when we are at various different fields, varying temperature, and one sees that electric polarization develops only in this LTI phase. So exactly as was expected based on the symmetry analysis, only this phase is ferroelectric, and it is ferroelectric. You can actually measure
the magnitude of this ferroelectricity. It's a relatively small polarization if you compare to any other, you know, sort of regular ferroelectric materials. These are really quite minuscule amounts of polarization. But they're still very interesting for us because they reveal this coupling between the inversion symmetry breaking magnetism and ferroelectricity. Okay. Yeah, you can also play around and do things as a function of field. And then you can either have the electric polarization turn off when you apply the field, or it can turn on when you apply the field. But this really all has to do with just cycling in and out of a certain phase in the phase diagram. So the bare and important experimental result is the observation that this red phase is ferroelectric. OK, so now let's just summarize the phenomenological observations that we have. there is a model that's discussed a lot and which surely is relevant in a lot of different systems. It says that the electric polarization should be expected on some in some conditions to behave as such as a function of the spin vectors and the vector that separates spins I and j. And what this roughly tells you is that the electric polarization tends to lie in the plane of the cycloidal or spiraling state. And this was exactly what we observed. You remember the spiral was sort of, I guess, yeah, I had this guy here being my spiral previously, and this was the B direction. Oh, you probably lost it by now, but the B direction was also the direction of the electric polarization. So the electric polarization was in the plane of the spiraling spins, and that is consistent with this so-called spin current model. I won't say a lot more about that one right now. Yeah? No, to be honest, this works in some cases, but I'll show you a case where it doesn't work. And it's not quite clear to me. This is just the phenomenological parameter that shows up. So. All right. The other thing we've seen is that magnetoelectric phase is an increment, tends to be an incremental cycloid phase. This is the other important point, is that the magnetoelectric phase develops from an existing incommensurate order in this material. Remember, I already had the amplitude modulated state. Something more happened, and I acquired ferroelectricity. It was not a transition straight from paramagnetic state into magnetic ferroelectric state so far. So that's what happens in this Kagame staircase material. Now, let me give you a couple of hints as to the theoretical description of that. And actually, Brooks Harris has written many very, very nice papers about these things that I highly recommend. Yes?
You explained nicely how the cycloid phase doesn't have inversion symmetry.
Yes.
And you said that it does display the polarization. But so the polarization implies some displacements of the. So why is that required? I guess why would the polarization and the displacements be required? There's a step I'm missing.
OK, so that is the normal step of symmetry analysis, when you say that once the structure, you know, you have some sort of system where I have, you know, we've indicated that there will be some form of a coupling between the lattice, which is a electrically polarized medium, and the magnetism. So once you have that coupling, you would expect that the symmetry of this electrically polarized medium would have to be consistent with the symmetry of the magnetic system. And so if I have a magnetic structure that breaks inversion symmetry and breaks and is polar, then I would assume, you know, it would have to be some sort of awful accident for it not also to be ferroelectrically polarized. I mean, if it was a metal, then you would have a reason for it not to be ferroelectrically polarized. But once it's polarizable, it ought to assume all of those symmetries. And also, so we're pushing a lot of complexity under the rug with that argument. But I think that's appropriate at this stage. In fact, some people may not want to go further because it becomes very messy once you get into the details.
The idea roughly is that it can lower its energy by modifying the exchange interaction above and below. Is that?
Yes. So once it's decided I want this ordered structure, then you can tweak the exchange interactions a little bit. And that happens by some distortion of the lattice. And this distortion must satisfy the same symmetries as the magnetic structure.
But that argument doesn't require any spin orbit.
right?
No,
at all.
It doesn't.
Which is why I was surprised by this cross product. That seems to be far too over.
Yeah. In fact, I don't espouse that expression at all.
Okay.
In the later slide, I'll show you material which is described by this trilinear coupling term, but which is not described by this spin current.
Okay.
So this is the term that Brooks Harris picked up, and it's the second time today we see a trilinear term, but in very different context here. So in order to conserve momentum, I need two magnetic order parameters which might be of different transforming according to different irreducible representations. And then I can involve the electric polarization as well. So these are my three different order parameters that can show up. And then there's a prefactor here, which I won't be able to calculate, but I'll be able to use symmetry to decide which of these prefactors can be finite. Some of the prefactors may have to be zero, depending on the symmetry of the magnetically ordered state. So shown out here is the little table of characters for each of the four irreducible representations that are associated with that little group that you have once the magnet has ordered and has a certain defined incommensurate wave vector. So then you have these particular representations available, and here you have the various different symmetry operations that still are present in the ordered magnetic state. So then we are first going to look at the high temperature incommensurate structure, and there we only have one irreducible representation. After all, that phase was acquired through a second order phase transition, and so it should only be able to have one representation come forward. And that happens, and that was determined experimentally, to be this gamma 4 irreducible representation. And so if I have a trilinear coupling, then I have to simply have mod squared of that order parameter present. And that means that this term actually has to go away, because this term is not, for example, invariant under the rotation around the x direction. This one would, I mean, actually, with all of these operators, I can ensure that each of these gamma terms, gamma now being the Cartesian index of the electric polarization, each of these parameters has to vanish. So that one, this trilinear term simply has to not be there in the high temperature incommensurate state. But in the cycloid state, that one is described by two irreducible representations. And because there are two phase transitions that happened, you know, first you went into the amplitude modulated, then you acquired the transverse component that went out of the board. That one is described by the gamma 1 irreducible representation. And looking at this term here, one finds that that one is actually invariant under all of these symmetry operations. So this term is allowed to exist. I can't say anything about the magnitude of that parameter, but because it must, because it's allowed to exist, I should be seeing this type of coupling between the magnetic order parameter and the ferroelectric polarization P gamma. P y. It's only the y that can exist. If I try with x or z, you'll find that some of these symmetry operations do not leave this one invariant. Okay, so that tells me polarization along the B direction, which is actually what was observed. Now, there's something more we can do experimentally, because we can look at the temperature dependence of this term here through neutron scattering, and then compare that to the temperature dependence of the electric polarization. And they will be found, I'll just show you on the next graph, they will be found, in fact, to be, when I look at this product of the amplitude for each of those magnetic order parameters and compare it to the temperature dependence of the electric polarization along the B direction, one finds that those are actually in quite good agreement with each other. And this, I think, constitutes quite strong experimental evidence that this trilinear term is in fact the one which at the phenomenological level is inducing the multiferroic behavior of that material. All right, let's see, I think I'm running a little bit late, and so I might skip forward to a different subject. All right. 10 minutes. No. Okay. All right. Okay. So then I guess maybe I'm.
you're indicating that I should continue. And current slide, okay, let me, I do like it a lot, this one. So it would be a shame to, okay, so this is, now we're going to look just at a different system. It was again a material that we that popped out of the drawer because of frustrated magnetism. It's actually just a beautiful example of a triangular lattice antiferromagnet. The red dots here are iron, the spin 5/2, and it's a rather two-dimensional system, the interactions being stronger in the plane than between the planes. And it's also pretty complicated, and there's one particular aspect of it that I really want to point out, which is that you have these four oxygen atoms forming a tetrahedra, and those can either be above or below a triangle of iron atoms. See, for this particular triangle, there's such a tetrahedron below it, whereas for this triangle here, there would be a tetrahedron above it. It's not shown because of the way I've drawn the structure, but it's either the tetrahedron is below the triangle or above the triangle. And that turns out to be absolutely crucial for the multiferroic behavior of this system, because that means that there is not a mirror plane coincident with the triangular lattice plane. And once that happens, then we claim from my experience with this material that whenever you have a 120-degree spin structure, then you will also have ferroelectric behaviors coming out of that system. Here's a picture where I have shown it just along the b-axis, and you can see that this tetrahedron is also twisted a little bit. That is important as well, not for the ferroelectric properties, but it leads to a competition between near and next near neighbor out-of-plane interactions that actually give rise to a incommensurate modulation of the 120-degree structure. I'll show you on the next slide how that comes out. So these two features are important. I have a tetrahedron either above or below a given triangle, and this tetrahedron is slightly rotated. All right, so I have frustrated magnetism, I have magnetic order eventually, and I have a complicated phase diagram versus magnetic field and temperature. We've measured the ordered magnetic structures in each of these phases. And in this phase, it turns out that what I have is basically a 120-degree structure on each of the triangular lattices. But then as I progress along the c-axis, then the triad of spins is sort of rotating in some incommensurate fashion. And this comes about due to the competing near and next near neighbor interplane interactions. OK, now once, what? The coplane there.
This is field in the plane. Now, once I apply sufficiently strong field in the plane, then it becomes awkward to have this triad rotating like that. So I'd like it locked with respect to the applied magnetic field. And so then you actually go into this type of structure. We won't talk a lot about it. So that's actually a commensurate structure. And that's a structure that has a point of inversion. So this phase is not expected to be ferroelectric. This phase, on the other hand, is expected to be ferroelectric, and I'm going to go through the Landau expression in a little. What I'm showing you here is the experimental evidence for ferroelectricity in that system. This is the electric polarization, but now the electric polarization is perpendicular to the triangular lattice plane, and then we have it compared to the intensity of magnetic diffraction. And they actually agree with each other. Magnetic diffraction scales as the magnetic aura parameter squared. And so magnetic aura parameter squared is acting, if you will, like an electric field, an effective electric field on the polarizable medium. OK, now, this is the Landau theory is actually simpler for this system because there's really just one distinct irreducible representation involved. But there's sort of two versions of it. And the key thing here is that on the triangular lattice, OK, let's see here. The triangular lattice, so we have a, we might draw a hexagon to illustrate that. The type of pattern that I would have is this. And I repeat these in the regular fashion. This triangle, as viewed from here, could be said to have a plus sign associated with it as I traverse the triangle in this sense, the spins rotate in the same direction. This triangle is going to have the opposite of that. This one again plus, this one minus, plus, minus. So it's sort of a a structure where each triangle is a chiral object, but overall the plane does not have chirality associated with it. Now what comes in here, and which is important, is that I do have broken inversion symmetry, but furthermore it is also a polar structure. Why is it a polar structure? That has to do with that little tetrahedron. So the tetrahedron, remember, was either above or below the triangles. And so we can agree that the positive direction, if you will, is the direction from triangles with positive chirality towards this tetrahedron. And then I have a means by which I have established a direction for the structure. I'll be able to tell if I've turned it upside down on the basis of that. And so this is my sort of back of the envelope argument that this should also be a ferroelectric structure. Now this is the effect of the inversion operator, and this is then in the end the free energy which is consistent with symmetry, and you can see that this is the nature of the trilinear coupling term in that case. And I have two irreducible order primes, and they actually correspond to either putting the plus chirality triangles on these sides or switching it so that there would be minuses here and plus there. That would be sigma 1 and sigma 2. I would not expect to find in the same volume of material both sigma 1 and sigma 2. The quartic terms are going to remove that possibility, and so I'm either going to have a lot of this guy or a lot of that guy, but I'm going to have some sort of domain distribution in such a way that parts of the crystal where this one comes to prominence, those parts I'll have the electric polarization, I guess, pointing in the minus z direction, and when this one comes to prominence, I'll have the opposite orientation of the electric polarization. So I have this coupling between the chiral nature of the magnetic state and the direction of ferroelectric polarization. Okay, now that is something that we wanted to prove experimentally, that there was this connection between the sort of chirality of the magnetic structure and the direction of ferroelectric polarization. We've not been able to do it for the triangular lattice structure for technical reasons that we can discuss in private. But for this other Kagame lattice structure, we were able to do that. So the idea here is that we want to apply an electric field to select the direction of the electric polarization, and then we want to detect a change in the magnetic structure. This change is very subtle because it has to do with altering the sense of rotation of these spins. That's something you can't detect with unpolarized neutrons. You actually need a polarized neutron beam, and we do use polarized neutrons. We generate them by using polarized helium 3. And so what we can do is we can come in with, and I'm going to talk about spin up, spin down, and spin up. I could come in with spin down and detect the probability of diffracting to spin up. I could compare that to the opposite situation of coming in with spin up and then leaving with spin down. And an imbalance between those two diffraction processes would indicate a structure that actually has a handedness associated with it. And that's exactly what we saw when we apply a big electric field in the B direction. So that is perpendicular to the Kagame lattice planes. Then I can favor either the one type of diffraction process or the other type of diffraction process. And then when I switch the direction of the electric field, then I also switch the sense of polarization in the experiment. Let me skip that one, but I did want to show this graph, which is where we actually compare a hysteresis loop measured for the chiral magnetic structure to the hysteresis loop associated with the electric polarization. So the red dots show the asymmetry of the polarized beam diffraction process, starting off with a sample that was just cooled in zero electric field. You apply an electric field, you get it, you acquire some chirality in the structure, and then you can cycle around this loop. And then we can also measure the surface charge density by using this pyrocurrent measurement, and one finds that exactly the same. That really is a coupling between these two. This is our experimental evidence for a microscopic relationship between domains that have ferroelectric polarization and domains which have a certain magnetic chirality associated with them. All right, and then I want to simply conclude. So this is more or less a summary of what we've been talking about. We're quite interested in the fact that I think there should be a lot of, if we can find other triangle lattice antiferromagnets, there's a good chance that they'll be multi-thoroic. And we've demonstrated this electric control of chirality. Lots of plans for the future in this area, and some of these things are harder than others. The one that I'm almost most interested in now is to be able to use an electric field to affect the critical properties of various interesting frustrated magnets. Thank you for your attention.
So when you introduce this magnetorestriction, you emphasize the fact that if the spins go from a favored to an unfavored orientation, that can exert force. But the other aspect of it that I always think of is has to do with the bond angle between magnetic ion, oxygen, magnetic ion, which if it's somewhere around 90 degrees, the exchange interaction is changing from ferro to anti-ferromagnetic. Yeah. And so that, which is also, by the way, the place where DJDR will have its maximum, right? Because it's passing through zero with maximum slope. So in the system, the vanadate that we studied, which was cobalt, I guess we found that the exchange interaction along the spines was, as far as we could tell, zero. Okay. Whereas it was the exchange interaction between with the bridging ones that was the one that was determining, you know, the spin wave spectra. Okay, so interestingly, you took first neighbor competing with second neighbor and got a very delicately balanced structure, whereas we took just first neighbor and said, well, it's in that different system, of course, it's as if it were zero along the spines. The ground state in the cobalt system is basically ferromagnetic with large anisotropy along the spine direction. And in any case, these are just different facets.
Yes. I'm going to say that there have actually been ab initio calculations now by Kenneth Ludren where he calculates some of these exchange constants. Mm-hmm. And he was actually able to produce a ratio that was more or less consistent with what we found by analyzing the incommensurate wave vector. So the other thing he found was that these were not the only interactions by far. And in fact, they're quite good interactions between subsequent hexagonal layers and so on. It's just a tremendously complicated.
Yeah, those are very difficult calculations.
Yes. I was quite impressed by what he was able to do. Here's a little picture of the structure. This is the spine direction, and indeed, I think it's very important about this angle. And what one can imagine is that slight adjustments of the location of these oxygen atoms could affect the ratio of this exchange interaction, the near and the next near neighbor interaction. And I'm pretty sure that that's going to be playing an important role. But of course, once you get the spiraling structure, you know, the spins spiraling in this direction, then somehow it's the corresponding displacement of these oxygen atoms, which is acquiring a electric polarization. Yes.
So, how strong is the local electric field in these compounds, and when you go in the ferroelectric phase? I mean, I'm trying to see where did the charge come from at the microscopic level. I mean, because, for example, in a Hobart type picture where we have electron hopping, I can imagine that when I have a non-collinear structure, I can accumulate locally some charges in some kind of large U Hobart model. But here, presumably, it has to do with rearrangement of the electrons that participate to the super exchange, right? There's an electric field, so there has to be charge movement, right?
Yeah. I'm maybe very naive, but I'm sort of thinking of the actual atoms which are charged moving about and not worrying too much about the corresponding asymmetry of the electric charge distribution, but that's not right, I'm pretty sure. I mean, you're right. I mean, there will be some sort of off-centering that would occur and so on. The one thing
in all these materials, it would be an off-centering of the atomic charges.
But the one thing I'll say is that, unfortunately, you know, it is such that the electric polarization is extremely small in these things, and so the displacements, if we were to assign all the charge just to like point charge model or so, then these displacements would be in the range of 10 to the minus 4 angstroms. I mean, just awfully small numbers. And that's on my scheme of things to do. We also wanted to try to detect some of these changes by diffraction experiments, but it's going to be tremendously difficult, I think.
So that hasn't been done.
Hasn't been done yet.
Actually, actually, I wonder if I could ask just a final question. So getting back to the Microsoft space constellation, have you, in the NIL mandate, have you done the last measurements of the space expectation?
Yes.
And
what we find is that there are a large number of very flat bands, which span a very wide range of energies, actually, and which have a substantial gap in the excitation spectrum as well. So that's consistent with this uniaxial anisotropy being quite important in the nickel system. It's also consistent with the frustration in general, you know, having almost zero group velocity nodes in the system. It's also just quite complicated there.
But do you see dispersing ones?
Some of them do disperse.
In addition to the flat ones?
They disperse, but not anything compared to the full bandwidth, you know, it's sort of maybe up to a quarter or so. And this is sort of an active analysis in doing the calculations. What we're trying to do is to take the numbers that Tanner calculates from ab initio and just calculate what the dispersion relations would look like in uncomputing.
You should calculate it, right?
Okay, well, if there are no further questions, let's thank Colin for